Podcast. I'm here with my co-host Stephen, as always. And we are, as always, recording this in the middle of the night because that is when we were both awake and that is when we were both had enough to drink to record a podcast. So today's podcast is going to be something that comes up a lot for writers. And whether you're assigned to a book deal, whether you're not, this is something that, or whether you aspire to be assigned to a book deal, this is something that we think all writers are going to have to deal with eventually. And this is something that pretty much everybody has to deal with eventually, and that is professionalism in your daily life. And I've developed kind of an intricate philosophy of professionalism for myself, and things that make me say, okay, this is what a professional writer is, this is what an amateur writer is. But Stephen and I have recently been talking about what a professional and what an amateur is, and I have recently submitted some of my work, which was previously self-published, to a sort of a mid-level publisher. Not like a big one, not like Macmillan or anything, but a publisher that sort of specializes in traditionalist literature. I'm not going to say which one, but I will tell you this little story here before we get going, and it's an example of how you should not work as a professional. So I wrote up a proposal page that is essentially a consolidation of the story that I wrote for Autumn Leaves, that novel that maybe some of you, if you've been listening, have heard me talking about. If you haven't, it's called Autumn Leaves, a novel of old Japan. Go buy it off Amazon. It's very good. I assure you it is. Or it's going to become very good, or going to become even better is a better way to put it, because I'm going to hopefully have it edited by a really good editor friend of mine. But this is contingent upon me getting this book signed by a particular, or not necessarily a particular, but signed by a publishing house. And I do have one particular publishing house in mind because I've been working with them for a while now. But yeah, whenever I submitted my query letter to them, I did it without turning off the markups because I'm a dumbass. Because I was so excited that I just wanted to get it submitted, so I forgot to turn off the markups. And whenever their editor got back to me, he said, within a few hours, so he was happy to hear from me, he was happy to hear me say this, he said, hey, great, I love your idea, I love your concept, thank you for submitting this to us, but I almost didn't read it because you forgot to turn off your markups, which is a really amateur idea, or a really amateur move. And then I was like, oh god, oh man, I'm so screwed, I don't know what to do now, I'm never going to make this up. But I was overreacting and hyperreacting, and my friend, the editor, his name is Brett, he brought me down a little bit. He was like, okay, it's no big deal, you know, just submit your first chapter, which is what they want you to submit. And I did. And the first chapter I submitted also had markups in it. So I panicked, and I submitted a very rough version of the first chapter about 5 minutes later to this same editor without any kind of markups in it. It was just the edited version that went into my PDF book that you can buy on Amazon. I just copied and pasted it into a new document so that it was only the first chapter. And that's something that's been bothering me ever since, because this was about a week ago that happened. And I've been just sort of racking my brain thinking, God, I'm unprofessional. God, I'm unprofessional. What is wrong with me? And I realized we're all human. We all make mistakes. You know, if he reads it, if he doesn't, such is life. Self-publishing goes on. People will continue to read the book. People will continue to buy the book. They have in the past. They will in the future. I just thought this was a great way to get myself going as a author with a pretty good publishing house. And I've known some people at that publishing house. I have friends there. And I really hope that they pick this up and publish it. But if they don't, you know, so be it. But that's what I wanted to kind of get you guys going on this story here. We all make mistakes. We all screw up. We're all unprofessional at times, but that doesn't mean that you can't strive for professionalism, and that doesn't mean you can't strive for greatness.
Yeah, you know, I think I sort of had it lucky as far as, you know, making sure I'm professional and things go. I am an only child my father was a CPA, and my mom did, you know, they were both accountants, and so, and they both ran their own business. So I had, growing up, great examples of being, you know, very professional, and you know, and it's benefited me ever since. But I think I think a lot of times it's really important for even if you don't want to be published, even if you, you know, you just want to be self-published. You know, it's really, you know, doing that isn't a way around being professional, I don't think. I think it really is important. Because even if, and I hate saying just being self-published or something, because I mean, I think publishing has and will continue to change. It's far from what it was, but if that's what you want to do, it's not a way around being. You still have to be professional and come across professional at some point. I mean, if you are not coming across in a professional way, even as a self-published writer, then you know people are not going to take you seriously. Your readers may not take you seriously.
Yeah, I feel the same way because on my Amazon page for Autumn Leaves, there are some negative reviews, and they mostly deal with publishing or the editing, and that's after I spent several thousand dollars, yes, several thousand dollars on editors, who basically ripped me off, and I should have just gone with editors that I trusted, editors that cost a little less, but I didn't. I thought that, you know, hey, an editor that charges $1,200 for a first draft, hey, that's, you know, going to be a great draft, and I was wrong. But there's a thing that one of my professors, an old professor of mine, used to hammer into us, and it's called due diligence. And it means do your due diligence, whether you are hiring a professional editor or not. Go back and look over your book. Look over everything you can. Make sure it's what you're going to be proud of. And that is something that I didn't do because I was, when I wrote Autumn Leaves, I was very timid and I was very nervous. And even though I'm basically an extrovert, in terms of my personality, that Briggs Myers thing, I'm like the ENTJ or something. The debater is what I am. I'm basically an extrovert. I basically like to talk. I basically like to you know, absorb other points of view. But he, my professor always made it clear to us that due diligence was the number one thing you can do as a scientist. And I'm not a scientist anymore, but I was at one point. But due diligence is incredibly important. It's something you have to do. It's something you have to be responsible for. I should have been responsible for looking over every single word in my book, whether I sent it to an editor or not. And you know, that itself kind of reveals a limitation of the author, though, doesn't it? No matter how good you are as an author, you're not going to see all your big problems, are you?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, it was interesting. I was watching a Periscope that Vox Day did, and he does all his own editing. And he was talking about that actually. You know, because he edits a lot, or I don't know if he does all of them, but he edits the books that he publishes out of Castalia House. And he was just talking about this writer that you know, he went back to and said, hey, you know, I want the rest of this is good, but this beginning or first, you know, whatever, this first part needs to be, you know, a little something else. And so the writer then rewrote it. But he was kind of talking about how, yeah, with himself, he doesn't have that sort of, obviously that external objectivity to his own writing, where he can go in and think like that and force himself to make some of those changes. Now I'm assuming he does, since he edits his own work, but yeah, it's a lot more difficult to be that person on the outside when it is your work, when it's your your ideas and passion that's gone into the writing.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you were to sit there and think, okay, you know, I have to cut this scene, I have to cut that scene, I have to cut that scene. When you are thinking that way as a writer or as an editor, what you're thinking of is the way you were as a writer, as, oh, I put so much effort into the scene. This was such a good scene. I'd love to have it in the book. You are sentimental about certain scenes. You're sentimental about a lot of scenes, I think. And maybe that was some of my problem with Autumn Leaves, is that I just thought, God, you know, the book wouldn't be the same without this particular moment. And that's something that I kind of matured about between Autumn Leaves and Andy the Ninja, because Andy the Ninja I was able to just sort of eviscerate, because it started out as a 300-page novel and it ended up being a 200-page novel. I was able to just cut out all kinds of crap that I thought, this isn't really funny. This isn't really working. This is kind of stupid. Do I really need this in here? And as I went, I thought, I don't really need this. In a satire, I don't really need this. But, in a historical book like what I write and what I'm trying to write for my next book, which I'm not going to reveal the name of it yet, but it's my Renaissance book. There's a part of me that just wants to reveal every little corner of architecture and art and science and music and mythology and the legends and the way these people lived. And that to me is just like, it's just so fascinating because I trained as a historian and I'm a natural born historian in some ways, as one of my editors just said, that, maybe I need to take a better look at what I'm writing, because maybe some people don't give two shits about the architecture of the Renaissance and the subtle nuances between the way a cart was built in 1490 versus the way it was built in 1320, but yeah, that's kind of something that I struggle with right now is the being able to kill your babies, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I remember, and I wish I remember where I read it, but it was one of the things that was something that John De La Rose had put out. I want to say it was like a blog or something that he wrote around the time that his book came out a few weeks ago, For Steam and Country. And he was writing about, he mentioned all of these things that he had sort of, just about the world of, whatever it's called, Somelandia.
I forget the name of it as well.
And certain characters, different things about the backstory that he had to, cut out or just write, but then not include into the book, because it was something maybe he had to understand to write it, but wasn't important to the story. And especially for like a fantasy sci-fi like that, there's going to be a lot of things like that that are probably, especially when it comes to creating your own world, that the reader doesn't need to know about. I could definitely see that with a historical novel, it would be much more difficult in some ways, because you almost don't want to not include this or that, because it just seems so important to the history. But I don't know. It seems like a unique challenge.
It really is, because I'm reading right now a book by Jacob Burckhardt called The Civilization of... Let me get this over here. The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy by Jacob Burckhardt, which is an older book, but it's kind of the quintessential book on Renaissance Italy, and it's got all the kind of little intricate details you could ever possibly want about it. But it's not widely praised by modern historians, because Burckhardt was a historian of the 19th century. He's not a Marxist, as far as I can tell. Maybe he is, and I just haven't picked up on it. But he is somebody that I'm going to as a reference for much of what I write. I'm also reading a book called Venice by Thomas F. Madden, who is a great historian of the medieval world. And I'm learning a lot about Venice through that, because this story is the story of Florence versus Venice, Florentine people versus Venetians. And it's about the way that they conflict, the way that they view love, the way that they view war, the way that they view government, the way that they view themselves. Individualism versus collectivism, living for yourself versus living for your people. And that's really something that I'm dealing with here in this novel. But it is in some ways in an essay, because these are essays that I've written for other websites that I'm basically stealing from the Renaissance. But yeah, this is very difficult, and it's difficult to edit it, because what I want to do is I want to create the perfect, the quintessential world of the Renaissance. And there are times when I just look at this thing and I think, I have to cut this. I can't have this in here, because it's narratologically, it's distracting. But then there's another part of me that says, no, this is not a movie. You don't have to have, this is not a Steven Spielberg movie. Steven Spielberg's movies are A to B to C. You can have A1, A2, A3, A4, B2, B3, B4, whatever. You can have that in a novel, and you can't have that in a movie. And so I'm just kind of thinking, is it cool? is it fun for people to stop the narrative for a second and just let me explain the way, Venetians under Innocent VIII, who was the Pope in 1490, was maybe I should just explain spiritualism for them for a little while. Maybe I should just explain the way they viewed the Catholic Church. Because there is a kind of an interesting change going on here. Have you ever read the book Silence by Shusaku Endo?
No.
Okay, this is a movie that just came out and was directed by Martin Scorsese. And Shusaku Endo's book Silence deals with the hidden Christians of Japan. And it deals with the two monks from... They were Portuguese monks. Portuguese Jesuits who showed up in Japan and attempted to spread the gospel there. And what happens is, I'm not going to ruin it for you, because it's a very good novel and I want you guys to go read it, Shusaku Endo Silence. But what happens there is very interesting, because they spread Christianity in the 14th century. But what happens is whenever the 18th century shows up, or I'm sorry, this 19th century shows up, and Commodore Matthew Perry and his gun show up and the French show up, what happens is the Christians of that era don't recognize the Christianity practiced by the Japanese, so they're confronted with a possibility of two things. First of all, maybe the Japanese corrupted the Christianity that they were given, or B, the Christianity that they have is very different than 14th century Christianity that was passed on to the Japanese, right? So it's two possible answers. But I think that you as an author, and as Shusaku Endo does this very well in his book, you are obliged to not play with straw men. You are obliged to treat things that you don't necessarily agree with respect and with honesty and with honor, and to treat it as if it were something that maybe if you were in their shoes, you would understand where they were coming from. So that is a lesson in professionalism that I take away from Silence, and that I also look at whenever I look at other cultures. We talked about this in cultural appropriation the other day.
Yeah, you mentioned this book in cultural appropriation, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, actually, I probably did because it's a great book. But yeah, that's something that I think about. Is if you're going to write about something that is alien to you, don't do it with a straw man. Do it with respect and do your due diligence. That is the essence of professionalism when it comes to writing a story that you yourself are not necessarily privy to, whether it's historical or geographical or ethnic.
Yeah. You know, I would certainly agree with that, but you know, I was very interested in what Mars Dorian had to say about, that same topic of cultural appropriation. And, you know, he said that, you know, he basically agreed with us that he said, yeah, you know, you should do your research and learn about another culture if you're going to write about them, but you don't have to. There's no rule that says, you know, you absolutely have to understand this culture to write about them. You know, you it can very much be your own imagination of that culture instead. But yeah, I know I definitely... think, especially, you know, if you're not writing a science fiction novel or a fantasy novel, and you want it to be a representation of the real world, certainly do your due diligence and learn about what you're writing about. If anything, people will just not think you're stupid.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is something that comes to me as a guy who trained as a historian. For those of you who don't know, maybe this is your first podcast listening. Professionally speaking, I'm a historian. I trained as a historian. I have many graduate hours in it. I have a master's degree, almost a PhD in history. And I take history very seriously, because whenever I think about history, I think about the fact that I owe something to the people who lived through that world. I owe something to the people who lived through medieval Europe. I owe something to the people who lived through 17th, 18th, 19th century Japan. I owe them the fact that I have to portray them with honesty and with truth. I don't want to misrepresent their lives. And there is actually a term for this in the medieval world, in medievalism. It's called medievalism. And this is a term that we use in the West, in the Latin West. One of my areas is medieval history. It's something I've taught in the past. It's something I enjoy. Medieval history is great. But we use this term medievalism to describe it, because so many people misunderstand the medieval world that what they understand is kind of, it's kind of a cross between Tolkien and, you know, Ivanhoe and a little bit of Thomas Mallory, Lamort d'Arthur. And that's what they understand about the medieval world, even though that's really not the medieval world that most people lived in. You know, you're far more likely to learn something about the medieval world through reading Barbara Tuchman than you will by reading Jacques de Molay, Thomas Mallory. Sorry. Guys, it's 2 a.m. and we're talking. Like, Uprising Review podcasts involve alcohol and middle of the night. So we hope you stay with us.
Yeah, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just saying, you know, there's this thing called medievalism, and medievalism is a way of looking at the medieval world that really doesn't have anything to do with the medieval society. It's not the real medieval world. Like, if you look at the Alexiad by Anna Komnena, that is a very different treatment of the way the Crusaders behaved coming through Constantinople during the First Crusade than some of the pilgrim diaries would portray it, as individual pilgrims came through Constantinople and down to Jerusalem. It's a really different thing. And also, you could say that same thing of Tolkien or of C.S. Lewis or of anybody who writes a kind of fantasy-like medieval world. What they're really doing is they're taking on the tropes not of the medieval world, but of medievalism.
So does that drive you crazy as a history major?
Dear God, you have no idea. I have had students, whenever, I don't teach U.S. history often, and I haven't in a long time actually taught it, but when I did, I had a short answer on who was John Smith, and I shit you not, half my class, probably 15 to 20 people, gave me the Disney rundown of John Smith and whoever, I think it was Sacagawea, or whoever that Native American woman
Pocahontas?
Was that he ran off with. Pocahontas, that's right. Sacagawea was, yeah, that was the Louisiana Territory, wasn't it? Yeah. But yeah, they gave me the story of Pocahontas, and I'm like, you fucking kidding me? Did you learn history from Disney? Do you even show up? If I ask you what my name is, would you tell me accurately? But yeah, medievalism does drive me crazy a little bit. But you know what? That's life. I don't really hate it. It's what we have to deal with in the professional world these days, which is kind of why I'm trying to get out of the professional world and just make myself a novelist.
Well, yeah. I don't know. The Tolkien thing wouldn't bug me, but the John Smith thing probably does. I don't know. They don't teach that well in school either. They kind of glaze over it. The whole, I don't know.
Well, not to get off track of professionalism in writing here, but let me tell you something about history. And that is that when you're starting American history, you really need, at this point, you need 3 semesters instead of 2 in order to get everything in, because there's military history, diplomatic, economic, frontier history, nationalist history, America's histories in Vietnam, the Cold War, America as a superpower. You can't cover all of this in 2 semesters. And then, let alone the fact that half your kids are either going to be black or Hispanic these days, or sometimes Asian, they want to know a little bit about what their families and their ancestors had to say about America. And you just can't do it in 2 semesters. We need to make American history 3 semesters minimum, maybe even 4 semesters at college.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to get us off too far off track, but let's get back to the professionalism. Let's get back to the question of, let's ask another question, a professional question, which is a research question. And that's something that I recently finished. I finished my research into my Renaissance Italy book. And it required me to go through about 12 books and read them. And it was everything from Thomas F. Madden's Venice to, Jacob Burckhardt and a few others in between. I just thought, yeah, and even some of these books weren't completely all devoted to the Renaissance, but still, it was a lot of research. And so let me ask you this question now. You haven't written a novel, but you have written considerably other things, short stories for the most part, if I'm not mistaken.
Lots of websites.
Let's ask, and websites. You're a marketing guy. Lots of websites. Yeah, maybe I just got you a new job, too. But Yeah, but where do you stop their research? How do you? Where do you say, I'm done? I've researched enough. Now it's time to start writing. Because I have it in my gut instinct, I know where that is, but in my brain I don't.
You know, yeah, I really think your brain is never done researching. I really think you always seem to think you need more. Because there always could be more you understand. You're never going to get to a point where you know everything about Renaissance Italy. So yeah, I really think it is kind of a and I hate putting it like this, but it's sort of a feeling that you can do it. Maybe a sort of confidence, or some sort of gut feeling that you're like, okay,
hubris, maybe. Yeah, hubris.
We can call it whatever we want to, but something that
the belief that you know, maybe the belief that you know enough about another society to be able to write about them intelligently, whatever word you want to use for that.
Yeah, I mean, we can call it what we want, but I think you really just need whatever trigger that is to really be able to capture whatever it is you're going for.
But that brings up another question, which is, and this is a question I have as a historian, as well as a writer, which is, how do you know what you're going for before you've even started to do your research? Because, like, I'll tell you, with my master's degree and my dissertation both, I sat down and did research before I knew what I was going for. Like, I knew the general time period, I knew the general topic, and I knew kind of who I wanted to write about. But I didn't have any particular question about them. I just wanted to start reading and finding out more about them. And that's really a trap that you can fall into as a graduate student, and probably also as a writer, is one more book. I just need this one more book. If I read one more book, everything will be fine. If I read one more book, I'll be ready to go. And I've met people in graduate school who have done that, and I've met people in writers' groups who have done that. Not that I've been in many writers' groups, but, you know, the few that I have. They kind of procrastinate everything, and research becomes its own procrastination, and that itself is deadly for a writer.
Yeah, and I think that really plays well into professionalism. I mean, it's just something you have to get over. You have to figure out what works for you, what you need to do, and really be disciplined enough to say, okay, this is no longer productive research. This is now holding me back. Because at the end of the day, yeah, you're creating a story. And that's what the focus really needs to be on. And starting out before you even know really where you're going is kind of awesome. Personally, I just think it's kind of awesome to start out research that way. And I really, especially in a more academic setting, I would say that's probably where you should start more often than we probably end up doing. But
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, we're also seem to be so opinionated on things like that, but before we even really get going and learning about them. But, I think it takes a discipline to know where to look, and really just through experience. I mean, you're not gonna get it right the first time, and that's okay. But, you know, at some point you need to, you know, just be aware of what you're doing. Just try to sit back, or take a minute to step back and just think, okay, you know, is this a, something that now I'm using to procrastinate, or, do I really not have enough to write this, and just try to be as objective as you can about it? And, you know, it's can't ever hurt to get a second opinion either.
Yeah. You know, I'll say a couple of things here. First of all, is that whenever I used to teach my students, my freshman level students, I always made them write a final paper because I didn't want to grade a final test. And so, lazy as I am, I'd rather grade, you know, 30 final papers that are 3 to 5 pages long than 30 tests. One of the things I always told these students was, you had to clear your idea with me. And the reason why is because after the first or second year, I think, I realized that students who are inexperienced with history and inexperienced with writing tend to do one of two things. Okay, they either bite off too much and chew too fast. They come up with a topic that's so big and so large that everybody has done it, and that there's just so much research available that they'll never get through it, and they'll never be able to come up with a decent grade. And that'll be something like, you know, tourism in post-World War II Germany. That's a pretty fucking big topic. Doesn't sound like it, but I guarantee you it's a fucking big topic. And or they'll come up with something like, you know, black aviators in 1943 over the skies of El Alamein. And I'm like, okay, you may find one book on that, but you're not going to find enough to write a paper. So your research is going to be really skimpy. And so that's one of the two things they would do. My students would do is they would either bite off too much to chew, or they would pick up a topic that was so small and so narrow. Like I had this one guy, he said his grandfather was a radio operator in Iwo Jima, and he wanted to write a paper about radio operators and the Marines in Iwo Jima.
Oh,
like,
gosh.
You can't. You're just not going to do it. There's not enough sources on it. There's not enough people who've talked about it. There's not enough books on it. So, and it took me a couple of weeks of talking this guy out of it, but finally he ended up writing something else. But, you know, that to me is kind of the essence of professionalism as a historian, is judgment. And that is being able to say, this is enough, this is not enough. And that's something that I think every writer needs to learn to judge for themselves. And maybe that's why I'm such a big advocate for history as a major for writers, more so than the MFA or more so than English, is because you learn that you have to research things, but you also learn that there's a point where you just sit down and write it. Because, and here's the important thing, history is, for all intents and purposes, a kind of entertainment, right? We don't think about that often, but it's true. If you go to a Barnes & Noble, you will see the fiction section is quite large, you know, but you'll also see the history section is quite large. And as a subset of that, you'll see that military history is probably the size of history itself, because it is a form of entertainment. People buy that stuff to enjoy it. They buy it because they want to live through the lives of heroic men, people who have done great things, people who have done amazing things. And that's something that you kind of need to acknowledge as a writer, is that, you know, your audience expects something out of you. And it means a lot more than, and genre is a lot more than just marketing tools. It means you expect something from your writer. It means your writer is going to produce something pretty cool for you, right? So that's kind of my piece that I have to say about history as a profession and history as it functions in writing. But yeah, that, you know, we started off with me screwing up a query letter and ended up talking about history again. So that's professionalism at 2 a.m. after a couple of glasses of wine.
No, well, actually, there was something else I wanted to bring up, and that's actually writing, like actually forcing yourself to sit down and really write. And that may be the most important part of, you know, being a professional writer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because here's the thing. I knew a guy in graduate school who took something like 7 years to write 15 pages. And I was like, you must be kidding me. Is that like a joke? And no, it wasn't. He showed me his 15 pages and he kept going back and rewriting those pages over and over again. But you know, this is what Jim Butcher calls it, butt in chair time. And that is, if you're going to be a writer, you just have to sit down and do the writing. You know, if you're going to be a historian, you have to sit down and do the history. If you're going to be a doctor, you have to perform the brain surgery or whatever kind of surgery. And if you're going to be a writer, you have to sit down and you have to put word to paper. You have to put thought to word to paper.
Yeah, and writer's block is like just it doesn't exist. It's in your head, so.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think writer's block is writer's block is an excuse that writers make to make themselves sound more romantic. It's the, oh, I can't write. I've got writer's block. I'm so harangued by my visions. I am so put off by everything in the world. I cannot sit down and write because nothing inspires me. And it's just bullshit. You know, fucking grow up. Just sit down and start writing. That's all I do. I mean, yesterday I sat down and I started writing the actual plot for my Renaissance novel. I sat down, I wrote out all the main characters, and then I started writing the plot down. My first drafts are always done in handwritten. Because to me, it just seems like if it's handwritten, it's something I can scratch out and I can just sort of write over it. And it's easier to get going rather than writing on a computer. But, that's another topic for professionalism is your method. But, that's kind of how I am about writer's block. I don't think writer's block exists. I think it's writer being lazy. I think it's writer sitting on his butt. I think it's writer doing everything but writing.
Definitely. You know, I read this article. I was actually looking for, I think I was looking for articles for the Uprising Review, link roundup. And I found this article that was, I don't even know. I was just ended up, I must've gotten there from Twitter or something. And it was this person who had talked about this 6 months of writer's block. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Someone had writer's block for 6 months.
Apparently.
How the fuck does that happen?
If you're not a writer.
That is retarded. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. If you're not a writer, it kind of makes sense.
Here's the thing. Well, yeah, but here's the thing to me. I think there are people who like the idea of being a writer more than they like actually writing. It's kind of, do you watch any of those cooking shows like Iron Chef or any of that?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, yeah, I do.
Okay, so it's always an amateur versus some professional, and it's always the amateur that kind of, or like Master Chef is another one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head, that is, you know, it's amateurs trying to be professional, and there's nothing wrong with that, being professional. There's nothing wrong with being as good as you possibly can at whatever you want. But I think that cooking and writing have a lot in common in that people think they can do it because they've seen it done so many times that they think it's easy. And also, I think people read a book or watch a movie or play a video game and think, well, it must be easy to write a book or make a movie or create a video game. In the same way, they think, oh, well, you know, I can eat an omelet, therefore it must be easy to make an omelet. So, you know, that's kind of where I am whenever it comes to that aspect of professionalism. You know, we are a society of people who write emails and sometimes write blog posts and write Facebook posts. And I think a lot of people, to them, that translates into their head as, oh, well, I can be a writer. You know, I have an idea for a book. But my response to that is always, you have an idea. You need 49 more at this point because a book is not an idea. A book is 50 ideas.
Yeah. You know, in writing today it's kind of awesome how much writing actually is, you know, through the internet. And I mean, everyone's kind of coming up and realizing or, you know, discovering, it's definitely a lot more than it seems like everyone wants to write a book or thinks they can write a book, but, you know, maybe never realizes that it's a lot more work than they think it is.
Yeah, and I've noticed, living where I do, that there are a number of ex-Californian writers who come to the city and think, oh, well, you know, this is a city that makes movies, and my city does make some movies. It's a city in the South. I'm not going to give it away, but there are people here who say, ooh, I could make movies in this city. And I'm like, oh, no, you can't. Because the fact that you couldn't get anything written in Los Angeles doesn't mean you're going to get written here. You're not going to find inspiration. You're not going to suddenly discover your muse. You're not going to change your writing habits. You are basically a person who doesn't write, but likes to think of themselves as a writer. You're a person who hangs out in the coffee shop eating carrot cake and drinking Cafe Americano for $5 that you have to pay cash for because the coffee shop I go to doesn't take credit cards, sons of bitches. But, you know, that's the places where these people are from.
Sounds like NaNoWriMo.
Yeah, well, it is. NaNoWriMo. That is its own podcast. That is 5 podcasts. I did that 1 year. Have you done NaNoWriMo?
I tried 1 year. Yeah.
I did it 1 year, and it was, I did meetups, and it was nothing but people bitching about Trump, bitching about Republicans, bitching about how they have writer's block, bitching about how they can't get anything done. And then there's like one or two people over in the corner who are trying to type something out, and they keep looking out from underneath their glasses at the people who are just sitting around bitching. It's nothing but an excuse to socialize with other people that want to be writers. NaNoWriMo is about wanting to be a writer, not about being a writer. So that's my beef with it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what I wanted to say about the types of people that I encounter in my city. And I don't suspect you have that in yours, but maybe you do. Yours is a kind of a big... You live outside a metropolitan area.
Yeah, I live around a lot of Mormons. So
Mormons like movies?
I guess so.
And hey, that woman who wrote Breaking Dawn is a woman, is a Mormon.
I believe she's from Arizona as well, yeah. Stephanie Meyer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I actually wrote...
But yeah, that's...
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, I wrote a parody not a parody. I basically wrote a whole thing making fun of her, because she sucks.
You should have turned it into Bondage Erotica, and you could have $500 million like E.L. James. Because I'm telling you, almost every woman on this planet likes to have her hair pulled, her ass smacked, and to be told she's a bad girl by her daddy. Hey, you guys knew I was gonna say something offensive. I've toned it down a little bit. I have because we're being syndicated through Superverse SF now, which I'm very thankful for. I've decided to tone it down a little bit. But hey, every girl likes to have her hair pulled and her ass smacked. Every girl does.
Let me just say, I write much much better erotica than E.L. James.
I'm not gonna say.
I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, I mean. I've never read it, but let's just say I was encouraged to see the movie by someone I was with at the time, when it first came out, and my thought was, like that Dakota Fanning, Dakota whatever her name is, chick, Dakota Johnson, Dakota Fanning,
yeah.
Whoever she was, like, that's what they got? That's the best thing they got for that movie?
Yeah. That's what my friend said the other day. He was like, yeah, they should have gotten someone a lot hotter for that movie. I was like, oh, yeah.
I know. She's not ugly, but she's like a 6 or something. Like, I could approach her in a bar and maybe have a shot.
Yeah, anyways.
Dakota Johnson, that's her name. She is the daughter of Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith.
Oh. I don't know who they are, so cool.
Don Johnson was that guy from Miami Vice, and Melanie Griffith is an actress, and I can't name anything she's ever been in.
But I don't even know what Miami Vice was, so awesome.
Oh, you're so young. Miami Vice was Crockett and Tubbs, man. Back in the day, they were Miami cops fighting drug lords and shit back in the 80s.
Okay.
But yeah, okay. But anyway, that's their kid. And she's like, moderately attractive. Like, I'd hit on her at a bar. But she's no supermodel. I mean, like, yeah, they could have found someone better. Hey, we have completely and totally drifted off the topic of professionalism. This is the way it goes here on the Uprising View podcast. We started out talking about the professionalism and how I managed to screw up admitting two manuscripts. And now we're talking about Don Johnson's daughter's titties. Professionalism, ladies and gentlemen, professionalism.
The other thing that we were going to mention about professionalism, and it's not a super huge... topic, I guess we could probably wrap it up with it, is this whole thing, and I don't know where you found this one, this is a weird one, but like to me it's just kind of what the fuck, but this weird new concept of imposter syndrome.
Yes, that's something I mentioned the other day in the Gab hangout, or in the Gab
that's right,
because there's a chat room that a lot of us on Gab have. Mine is gab.ai/ever-ever. Stevens is gab.ai/my eclectic self. Look us up on there if you want to see us. But yeah, we have this chat room, and I mentioned to somebody a thing called imposter syndrome, which is the belief that once you start to get successful, that you yourself are not responsible for your success, or that it will be taken away from you, or that you didn't really do anything to earn it. And that's something that I've met people that they've kind of dealt with over the years, because I do know a number of professional writers who've kind of gotten to the point where they're like, oh, okay. Well, I'm selling novels now, but is it really me? I mean, what if my next novel crashes? What if my next novel is terrible? And it's true also of video game people, because there are gamers in the city I live in. you know, or games industry anyway, there are people who say, you know, well, what if I made this one good game and people praised it, but my next game sucks and doesn't do as well? It's imposter syndrome, and it's something that professionals, I think, deal with on a regular basis, and it's something that I think we all have to deal with if we're going to be professional writers. So to me, imposter syndrome is a function of what I call the fear of success, because, and this itself is probably its whole own episode, but I'll kind of broach it here. And that is, I think most people are not afraid of failure. I think most people are afraid of success. Because fear of failure changes nothing. If you ask a girl out on a date and she says, no, I don't want to go, so what? Nothing in your life has changed. But if you ask a girl out on a date and she says, yeah, I'd like to go, what happens when you start liking her? What happens when you start loving her? Your whole life changes. Suddenly you're 26, and one day you were trying to get laid, and then the next day you're in love with a girl and she's looking at rings. You know, that's scary. Fear of success, I think, is a lot scarier than fear of failure. And I think that's where imposter syndrome comes from.
Yeah, or even just the idea, you know, that you're not good enough for, you know, if you're, you know, you're seeing success and you're not worthy of it. You're not, you haven't, you know, maybe worked hard enough for it, or you don't deserve it, or whatever. Yeah, just suck it up and deal with it. I mean, there's people out there who wish that they could do what you're doing. So stop being such a bitch.
Exactly. Actually, we got Steven to say the word bitch, by the way. That's going down for posterity.
Okay.
Okay. But yeah, that's another part of imposter syndrome, which is, you know, I mean, yeah, I understand that you've kind of got, you've got a lot in your mind. You're wondering whether or not you really deserve the credit. And I think maybe this affects people who worked for a long time for their art, for their project. And maybe they have friends who haven't made it. You know, maybe you're in a writing group with a lot of other guys who just haven't quite made anything out of themselves. And, you know, you start to pull ahead of the pack. I've been there. I've seen it happen. I've seen one author take off, while other authors sit back and wonder, why is it happening to him and not me? And I've been that author. And I'm not saying that I'm super successful or anything, because I'm not. I mean, if I was, I'd be like fucking E.L. James, right? But I'm not. So one day I might be. You know, if this book deal comes through that I submitted to the other day, that comes through, yeah, it might give me a little money. But, you know, imposter syndrome is definitely one of those things that I think it's worth exploring. In a professional sense, because, and maybe we should just dedicate an entire podcast to this. Maybe we should just get a psychologist on to talk about imposter syndrome, or someone who's really successful who's experienced it. You know, maybe we should do that, because we do have a number of interviews coming up here on the Uprising Review podcast. So maybe we should talk to some people like that about, you know, imposter syndrome.
That could be interesting, because that's pretty much all I have to say about it is don't be a bitch.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's really all I have to say. I don't have any final thoughts on professionalism other than do your due diligence, don't be afraid of success, and essentially act and treat people the way you want to be treated. Because what I've noticed about successful people is that money and fame don't change you. They just increase what was already there. They magnify what was already there. So like the really cool rich people that I know who've gotten rich writing books, they were cool before they were successful. And the people that I know who were assholes after they got successful, they were assholes before they got successful. They just didn't have the guts to admit it. So yeah, that's kind of all I have to say about professionalism right now. Other than make sure you check your fucking Word documents to make sure that you have the comments turned off before you send them in.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, my name is Everett for Stephen Willis. We are Uprising Review. This is the Uprising Review podcast. You can contact us at submissions at Uprising Review if you have something you want to write to us. If you want, or you want us to consider as a short story of yours, if you want us to talk about something on air, if you want to voice your concerns, podcast@uprisingreview.com is our email. We always respond to people either on air or in email if you send something to us. If you're listening to this through iTunes, rate, comment, subscribe, tell a friend. It'll help us out a lot. If you enjoy this, you know, we try not to be a podcast just for writing nerds. We want to be a podcast for everybody who enjoys the process of creativity, people who enjoy the process of just frankly listening to two guys at 2:30 in the morning drinking. You know, that's another aspect of it. because so many podcasts are recorded sober, aren't they? But yeah, that's where we're at right now. So for the Uprising View podcast, for Steven, I am Everett. Thank you guys for listening, and we hope you tune in next time.